Wednesday night, all mailbag edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Haven't done one of these for a little bit here. Got some great questions, a great response to my Facebook post. Joining me as often to go through all these, Danny LaRue, what's up?
Doing well. This was a really good group of questions. Like this one was actually one that in order to cull this into the amount of time we're going to do, we actually are probably going to have to skip some questions that are worth answering.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we always do because, you know, I mean, we get thousands and thousands of questions each time we do this. No, there actually are some really good questions, and and not only good questions, but really a dearth of bad questions as well this time. So it was really hard to call it out, and if we didn't get to yours, I'm sorry. One thing we also could do, too, is if you're going through the queues, you're putting in a question, and you see one that you like already that you really want us to answer, click the like button on it, and we can sort of do it almost like Reddit style to let the crowd kind of vote on the ones that we should do, unless, of course, they take a lot of work, in which case we
Yeah, the only other thing I'll mention is that I don't think we're going to do much on the Warriors-Spurs stuff because it's so long until they play that it's a little bit too abstract, at least for me right now.
Yeah, yeah, totally. All right, you want to get started
Let's
here?
Let's do it.
All right, what's your first one?
Okay, one from, and apologies to everybody whose names we butcher. That's just the way it is. I guess we'll start with one from Josh Whitmer, which is, do the Pacers have any chance of moving into the legitimate contender category in the East?
And legitimate contender, that to me means having a chance of dethroning a healthy Cleveland team in the playoffs. I think if Cleveland suffered an injury between LeBron and Love and Kyrie, you know, one of those three guys, then maybe. Although I would say even with Kyrie out, the Cavs have probably still been the best team, as they kind of proved last night at Boston. But I think that they are a year away from that, and they could have up to $30 million in space this summer. It kind of depends who they get. I mean, they're going to have to re-sign Jan Mahimi, but his cap hold would be pretty small. I think it'll only be about $6 million since he's making $4 million this year. So that'll be, hopefully they can bring him back because he's actually been very important for what they've been doing. But they can go over the cap to bring him back, although, you know, they might be a little worried about that with being a small market and the TV money sort of kicking in during the season. But anyway, that's an aside. No, I don't think they could beat a healthy Cleveland team this year, but maybe if they get a little bit more reinforcements, one more good wing, of which there are not that many on the free agent market this year, but or if they were able to get another good big, or even just if Miles Turner can develop, although even if it's a second-year guy, you don't necessarily expect that out of him to be a changing player at that level of the NBA.
Yeah, the other thing that I'll add in terms of next year being better is Miles Turner is 19 right now. He'll be 20 next season, and he will have, even though he's been missing some time, he'll have another year of experience. I think that what you said in terms of health is the most important thing. If Cleveland is full strength, what the Pacers don't really have is what would force the Cavaliers off their game, like, let's say, offensively. Like, what can the Pacers do that the Cavs would just sit there and, like, throw up their hands and say, we can't really deal with that?
Well, I disagree with that a little bit.
Okay.
And that's because other good wings take Cleveland out of what they want to do defensively. What they want to do defensively is just have LeBron kind of hide, help out some, get into the passing lanes a little bit, and rest. And you saw in that Bulls series last year, for example, they started off with Kyrie on Rose, Shumpert on Jimmy Butler, and the Bulls usually were able to have success in first quarters against that alignment because Butler is too big for Shumpert and Rose was too fast for Kyrie. Amazing to say that about Rose now, given how he looks this year, but that was actually true as recently as last playoffs. And then when they would actually go to what I kept tweeting about this, I'd say it's the real matchups. When they'd actually go to the real matchups with Shumpert on Rose and LeBron guarding Butler, it looked better. And Paul George is a better offensive player probably than Butler. Not probably, he is. And so Cleveland doesn't really have anyone else to guard Paul George. He's way too big for Shumpert. He'll just shoot right over the top of him. So that LeBron is going to have to actually guard someone probably from the jump. He can do that, but that could eat into his offensive effectiveness, especially since he's at a point now where, since his jumper is not working, he has to expend a lot of energy offensively to get to the rim if he's going to score.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But that said, I mean, I think they would be massive underdogs against the Cavs this year. And also, Monte Ellis, I think, is still someone who is going to be someone who could be attacked defensively. Jordan Hill, another real weak spot in the rotation, especially when you get into playoff time. So when you have guys who just are not playing that well, those guys can really become a burden as a playoff series goes on.
Okay, you want to ask one?
Yes. This is from Colin Doherty, I think is how you pronounce his name. What is your feeling around the league for the trade deadline next year? A crazy one like 2015, or most teams staying pat like 2014? What do you think?
Well, so I kind of classified in two different timelines. One is the present. I think the present is going to be very quiet. You know, maybe you see something small in the next little bit of just like a deal that they had basically already been discussed. But right now, we don't really have clear sellers and really clear buyers, like teams that are, I don't think there are teams right now that think they can jump into that top tier. But as we get closer to February, we could see some. I think the big difference, though, is that I don't think we're going to see many teams willing to cut into their salary flexibility just because teams are fundamentally optimistic. And so I think that people will value that. And so there will be a little bit less moving, but maybe we'll see some fun challenge trades this year.
Yeah, my prediction is that there are a lot of factors at play, almost all of which lead to there being less trades. One, as you mentioned, is kind of more teams are in contention, especially in the East. Another one is that moving players for a team like Brooklyn to get a better draft pick in addition to getting assets doesn't really help you at all. And also just that optimism about 2016, teams aren't going to want to eat into that space. Now, teams that are willing to eat into that space might actually have an advantage of kind of zigging when everyone else is zagging. But if you're Brooklyn, you know, one of the Bradford Doolittle suggested, you know, what if they just, the Bulls just traded Derrick Rose if he keeps playing this poorly for Joe Johnson, and just Brooklyn will try to rehabilitate him. But that adds $20 million to their books in 2016. And I think Brooklyn being in somewhat of a major market, or at least considering themselves in one, they're not going to want to have that opportunity cost for a guy like Rose, who probably isn't going to work out, maybe could just use a change of scenery or whatever. So, yeah, I think, and, you know, the Knicks are another one of those teams that if they fall out of it, still going to have their pick. So, yeah, I do not anticipate that is really going to lead to, and also there aren't really that many free agents to be on bad teams. That's typically the sort of trades that you'll see. And we speculated that a guy like Nick Batum, for example, could be traded if Charlotte fell out of it, but Charlotte's playing really well, so they're not going to trade him now. You know, they're probably going to overpay to keep him this summer if he keeps playing like
that.
Yeah,
and I think you could say the same for a guy like DeRozan, or on the opposite side for Roy Hibbert, just because his contract is so high that he's not in that realm where you can really say, oh, we can just find like Flotsam at that price. You can't find that with Roy Hibbert.
Yeah, well, the Lakers might be one team that decides they want to sell because they do need to be bad. They need to be in the top three to keep their pick. And so maybe they would take, you know, a second rounder for Hibbert. But as we've talked about before, there aren't really any obvious destinations for Hibbert. Sans injury for one of these other teams. Let's take the Melo question now, too, because that's sort of related to this one.
Okay. The one from Andrew. I think I have it. Andrew Thompson. If you were Carmelo, what teams would you be willing to waive your no-trade clause to join? And he gave an answer after that, but I'm leaving it open to you.
Yeah. I'll let you go first on this one. Let me think.
Sure.
About
I've, I've thought about it. So one thing to acknowledge is, of course, he has a family, he has a wife, and so that's a little bit different. But let's say it was just my decision.
Yeah, a wife who, by all accounts, really likes being in
Correct.
New York.
So for me, it would be the combination of being in a city that would be worth being in and a team that's competitive. So it would be Chicago, the Clippers, the Warriors, and probably New Orleans, because I think playing with Anthony Davis would be really fun. So I think that would be the core group. And yeah, I think that's really about it for right now.
Well, this is just places that you'd want to go, right? That's the question.
Right.
It's not where you could also realistically
Correct.
Trade.
Yeah, it's just
him, right?
It's just where you would be willing to waive your no trade. Yeah, like if there's no realistic trade to get him to the Warriors, but if he could get there, I mean, basically what you're doing is you're opening that door. I don't think there's...
Well, yeah, I'm sure he would want to go, you know, San Antonio or something wanted to get him, you would say, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. San Antonio
you know,
should be on it, too.
That sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to see a destination for him. I mean, Chicago is kind of the obvious one, but they really have typically not signed or taken on really bad contracts. That's one thing that they've generally have avoided. I mean, the Boozer one wasn't that great, but even that, you know, I think he was like 27 or 28 when he signed initially. Yeah, I'm sure he would be happy to go anywhere where he would have, you know, a good chance of just being in the playoffs regularly. I don't think the Knicks even now project to be there. And we'll see what happens with the Knicks too. You know, they could come back and look a little bit closer. Kristaps could be a little better. They do have this cap space. So maybe he's being sold on that vision a little bit and still likes being in New York. I'll tell you this much. Anywhere that he is going to go that's going to be a contender, he would not be the number one option. Maybe Miami would be the only one that you could say that, where he would be the clear number one option. But, it's tough. I mean, we knew it would be tough to trade him, especially now as he looks like he's not as good of a player as he was before the injury, and just because he's older and has that enormous contract, 3 years left on it after this year. Before we move on to the next question, I want to tell you about our sponsor, SeatGeek. SeatGeek is my go-to for tickets whenever I need them, whether it's sports, concerts, even, you know, the opera or something like that. Not that I am that cultured, but some people are. Certain many of our cultured listeners go to things like that. And SeatGeek is a great way to find tickets. It is an app that aggregates together all of your ticket buying options, so you can just go to one place. You don't have to worry that, oh, I'm not getting the best deal, I got to check all these different places. Because SeatGeek puts them all right in front of you, and they tell you whether it's a good deal or a bad deal by their deal score metric. What's more, you can actually now sell tickets on SeatGeek as well. They have the lowest fees of anyone in the industry, and because all those awesome people are going to be looking for tickets on SeatGeek, they will buy your ticket. And so that is a great way to make a little extra money if you can't make it to the event that you bought tickets for. Also note that my listeners get a $20 rebate off of their first SeatGeek purchase. You can download the free SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, you click the add a promo code, and then you enter the promo code CAPSPACE, which is all one word. Very easy to remember. We talk about CAPSPACE on this program all the time. And then you can get your $20 once you've made your first ticket purchase. So download that free SeatGeek app, enter promo code CAPSPACE today, and save yourself some money.
Yeah. Do you want me to pick the next one?
Please.
Okay, let's go to Austin Peters. Who is your coach of the year right now?
Luke Walton, easy.
I can see that. For me, what I like to
It just has to happen to me. Like it's just they're 24-1. You know, they might set the all-time wins record. They're well on pace to do that. It's got to be Luke Walton. Like there's just
yeah, because the crazy thing is the argument is who is basically, I would say, who has most outperformed their talent level? And the answer is probably the Warriors, just because 24-1 is so ridiculous. You know, like
you also have to think, too, of just the fact that as you get, you know, the better you get, the harder it is to improve, right? And so the fact that the Warriors, if they won 67 games, they improved by 6 games. That is perhaps a more impressive feat than improving by 15 games lower on the ledger.
Yeah, so the other people I would consider, I thought about this a little bit, would be Steve Clifford, Rick Carlisle, and Vogel. I think they've all done really good jobs. I think their teams have played above any limitations they would have. And also, those teams have all dealt with injuries, which is something that I also look for in a coach that's done a good job.
Hey, you know who else is pretty good? Greg Popovich. You ever heard of him?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think Popovich, he's gotten them to do now defensively, getting LaMarcus to buy in on that end, a guy who really has never been a part of a good defense before, though not I thought that his defense was underrated at times. I mean, they have a historically good defense right now. They have the same net rating as the Warriors do. I think those two. And it is hard to separate Walton from Steve Kerr because so much of the groundwork for this was laid last year. And it'll be kind of too bad if Kerr comes back and they do set the record or come close to it, if he doesn't get it just because he missed part of the season. So that, you know, that could end up really hurting him. But when you're doing a historic thing like that, you know, you look back on like 1996, for example, right? Phil Jackson won Coach of the Year, the only Coach of the Year that he ever won, by the way. Oh, no, he won it with the Lakers too in 2000, I think. But, And if they set the all-time wins record, if you look back, you know, if there was some team that, like, you know, went from like 40 wins to 50 wins or something and ended up losing in the second round of the playoffs, you look back and that just looks so dumb that that guy could have won it over Phil Jackson. And so I think when a team is having an historic season like that, you have to just pick
them. I agree with you completely. I think that the best coaches sometimes get overlooked for that exact reason.
All right, this is from Jake Stevenson. Do you guys feel that the importance of rebounding is decreasing as the league moves towards 4- and 5-out play?
I think it's actually getting more important. And the reason for that is you have less people in there. And so if you have an advantage over your person, then that's important. And also having more guys out means that guards, let's say like Westbrook or Curry or whoever, you know, there are lots of guards that can rebound now. Those players are more valuable because they're competing in a different space.
I'm torn on this. I think generally it's much less valuable. And part of the reason for that, part of what makes me say that is coaches clearly feel that way, right? They're just, how many guys are there now who are just straight rebounding specialists at the power forward position? Like, that's what the power forward position basically used to be. And you still even would have guys like Reggie Evans or Danny Fortson or even Rodman as a more extreme version, although he was also good defensively. Charles Oakley as another guy who a lot of what they did, their value, Horace Grant is another one. I mean, those guys could hit mid-rangers, but the biggest thing they did was rebound at the power forward position. You just see less guys like that. The other thing, too, is that teams now are emphasizing transition defense much, much more.
That's a big point.
And so they're just not going after the offensive glass. And if teams aren't going after the offensive glass, if less rebounds are contested on the defensive glass, then you can also just sort of not bother as much with having big defensive rebounders in there because you're just not going to get killed. Teams just aren't going after it. Now, I do agree with you in some respects because the teams that are outliers that can both get back on defense and offensive rebound, they can be more effective now than they were in the past because they're just much more outliers and teams don't have the defensive rebound to deal with them. Guys like Drummond, what the Cavs were able to do in the playoffs last year. But generally, offensive rebounding, a lot of time, it negatively correlates with giving up transition points at the other end. I think most teams have come to the conclusion now that sending a lot of guys to the offensive glass or having great offensive rebounders, which also, I mean, that's the other thing, too, is that offensive rebounding, just as an individual skill, great offensive rebounders are generally less skilled than most other players, right? I mean, and you look at and the guys who are skilled, they have the ball in their hands. They're not going to waste their energy going after the offensive glass and sprinting back. Like Blake Griffin is a great example of that.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately it has become much less important, but it does have more of a potential to be really effective for those few teams that can use
it. I like that you went to skill because what I was going to say in response was that when you have to make the choice between skill and rebounding, you choose skill every time. But the players that are going to really stand out, I think, in this era are the players where you don't have to make that choice. And those players, I think, have ratcheted up. And so you think about a guy like Draymond Green, who has very good rebounding instincts, and, you know, depending on where you can do that. And also, I think if you're a set, let's say you're one of those teams that doesn't really need your center to get back, and you can just, like, stick DeAndre Jordan or Drummond on the offensive rebounding, and that person is really good at it, that's something that you can really use.
Yeah, and also I will say, too, that in the playoffs, it can really kill you, right? Like, the Hawks got killed by Cleveland's offensive rebounding, the Bulls to a slightly lesser extent. So in the right matchup, it can be a real problem. All right, let's move on here. All right, yeah, you got one, actually?
Sure. Brandon Montgomery, what would you say is the biggest swing skill for a given prospect that could be the difference between them just being good or being a real star? And the examples he gave were Russell shooting, Porzingis scoring one-on-one, and Jahlil's defense.
I think Jahlil's defense would be the one to me where I think what he's able to do offensively, especially considering where it's just that he's just a rookie right now, that he doesn't have a ton of craft as far as getting into the line, the fact that he has nothing around him, nobody to really get him the ball on the pick and roll, no shooters around him, guys have no understanding of how to deal with it when he's doubled to cut or move to a new spot, all that. I mean, the guy can just get his shot off against a lot of guys. I mean, he just has so many moves. Like the move that he made on Joakim Noah the other night, where he just like basically he's the first guy I've seen do that sort of like one hand fake thing since Jordan, and he just almost made Noah fall down and then dunked it. That kind of offensive ability to create an instant double team, if he can get better defensively, and I think he can with his physical tools. I don't know about his mentality. You know, that could be the difference between him being a real superstar, top 15 player in the league, and just sort of, you know, a Greg Monroe type of guy. So I think because he is so good at that skill already, that's when I think Porzingis, on the other hand, is going to be real good, even if he just sort of continues to develop his existing skills of protecting the rim, shooting, I mean, those are the two main things at this point. Maybe offensive rebounding, though, that's begun to wane a little bit. I mean, I think he could be a real good player, second best player on a good team, even if he doesn't develop that one-on-one scoring skill. So I think that he has sort of a higher floor than someone like Okafor due to the fact that he can do things already on both ends.
Okafor's defense was my number one. My number two was Emmanuel Mudiay shooting.
Because
if Mudiay can shoot, I think he's a guy, another guy who has the potential to move into that really elite class of players. And if he doesn't, you know, like his variance is really high with that. And if he's on the low end, he becomes a player who's a much smaller part of a successful offense.
Yeah, and I would put, when you say shooting, I would even include his shooting at the rim as well.
Agreed.
That,
yeah.
Because he has not been effective there. And Denver's actually been playing much better without him, which is kind of sad, but that's what happens with rookies who, you know, are having some of the one of the most inefficient seasons.
Especially teenage point guards.
In history. Yeah, and you could throw even Justice Winslow shooting in there as well as another one.
Yeah.
That really could be huge. You know, I mean, if he never learns to shoot threes, he's going to be, you know, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist at best, you know. And if he does learn to shoot threes, that opens up his driving game. He could really be, you know, sort of a third best player on a real good team. I think ultimately, instead of, you know, he could end up as even just, you know, a glorified bench guy if he never learns to shoot.
Yeah.
Your turn.
Okay. I'll go to one that's towards the top. AJ Jamay, and I probably horribly pronounced that. I feel you guys are the only ones that are onto the Warriors' dirty little secret that the backups don't really mesh offensively. And the question was, would you think about keeping Brandon Rush in the starting lineup and saving Barnes to play the four off the bench with the other backup guys?
I'm glad that he acknowledged that it's crazy, because it pretty much
yep.
is. And I think there's just one supposition here that is wrong, and that is that they don't have enough minutes. Once Barnes is back, he's playing the four off the bench anyway. And he, I mean, the usual rotation is he'll come out with about 5 minutes gone by in that first and third quarter, and then just come back whenever Draymond Green goes out and play the backup four for 5-6 minutes. And then either he or Andre, depending on who's doing better, or if they go to the death lineup, will finish out the half. So I don't think they really, I mean, there's no reason really to play Rush, maybe a little bit as a backup too, depending on, you know, if Barbosa doesn't have it going or something. But they have plenty of minutes to go around once Barnes returns, so there's just no reason to even bother with Rush.
Yeah, there were two reasons I wanted to put this question in. One is what you just talked about, which is the idea of thinking of a 48-minute game, and you think about where everybody needs to play. And so somebody like Sean Livingston, who can play with both the starters and the backups, has that value. And the second part, which is something I actually my Warriors Weekly piece kind of talked about this, is that having a player in your starting lineup who doesn't really provide that much of a net benefit on either end of the floor really does hurt the starting lineup. And so the replacement of Rush with Barnes significantly hurts that group, because Barnes' defensive versatility is very important, and he's a guy who can make shots and does make shots. And so I think that it's hurt them. I think that one of those, they ended up winning the game, but I think that the way, you know, not playing Iguodala with the starters against the Celtics was something that nearly cost them that game too.
I agree, but once Barnes is back, you know, a lot of those problems.
Agree. Like they have a kind of an embarrassment of riches, but at the same time, you still need to manage everything well.
Yeah. All right, this is from Georgia Monroe Cook. Do you think there is some value in big shooting mid-range twos from the elbow as opposed to standing on the three-point line, and then it is easier to drive/operate from there rather than from the three-point line for less mobile fours and fives?
Do you want to start, or do you want me to start?
We really have to come up with a better system for this.
Well, usually I think the answerer would be the person who doesn't ask it. But I'll start with it. I just thought this is one. I thought I was going to ask you this one. For me, the answer is no. There is some value in it if the person can actually hit those shots. But it's creating space for the guys who are more capable ball handlers. It's not really creating space for the big. And a big that is good enough at handling in that space, you think about what Carl Towns has done. You know, Towns at certain points can get it a little bit further out and take a couple steps. So I think for having a big that the other team respects their jump shot is more valuable in that way because it gives you an extra couple feet for your point guards and your two guards.
Yeah, I understand what George is getting at here, which is the idea that especially for like a Blake Griffin type, she mentioned Draymond Green as well later in the question, that if you catch the ball there, you can kind of drive by and get to the rim in one or two dribbles. But I think the point you make about the space is important, that just you need to pull your man further out. Because if you're standing in kind of long two area, you don't require as hard of a closeout. And actually, if you can put the ball on the floor, and now she did say less mobile bigs, but if you are someone who could put the ball on the floor, you would rather be and hit threes, you'd rather catch the ball at the three-point line because that means the person's going to have a further distance to go to closeout, and because it's a higher value shot, they have to close out at you harder, and then you can really blow by them. Or you force someone else to go a further distance if you're helping. You know, it's not your man as well. So I think that standing at the three-point line is definitely better because also, you know, if someone's going to shoot a long two, that's kind of not the end of the world. And so you're not going to get as hard of a closeout, and you also just don't have as many steps to go. So you don't have to get up as high to as high of a speed to where you're going to get blown by. I mean, the rare times even that I've played pickup, trying to close out to the three-point line, the angles to actually like stay in front of someone afterwards are just so much harder way out there than they are even, you know, at closer to like the college line or so. And for the less mobile bigs, I don't think you really want those guys putting the ball on the floor anyway. So you would rather have them either spacing out or kind of right at the rim or diving to the rim, because either way, they're not going to get all the way to the basket. Someone's going to get over there and help. So you'd rather at least have someone have to close way out on them. And then if they do get covered up, then there's a switch that's occurred and you can move the ball or, you know, someone else is rotated over and you can find the open man along the perimeter or inside. So for all those reasons, the biggest of which is the spacing reason for your actual, you know, creators, I think it's much better to just be spaced out rather than be in the long two area.
Okay, one from Alex Balls. How much does coaching matter with a young team? I'm a Timberwolves fan. Everyone complains about Sam Mitchell, myself included, but then you look around at people like Billy Donovan, Alvin Gentry, doesn't seem like there are a lot of good alternatives.
Evaluating coaching is very difficult, even when you have a track record with guys. And it's even harder when the guy hasn't even coached at all. And so one of the theories that I've kind of had is that really teams should try, because you don't really know when a guy is going to be a good coach or not, that teams just need to kind of try more guys and try outside the box a little more, but then be willing to move on a little bit earlier when it becomes clear that the coach in question, it's not necessarily that he's doing a bad job, but it becomes clear that the coach in question is not really someone who's adding a ton of value. You know, if he's just sort of average, it seems like you can kind of find a guy like that pretty easily, and you should continue to search for someone who could be really, really good. I do think that Donovan and Gentry are both better than Sam Mitchell. I think that Sam Mitchell's philosophy, especially offensively, is just, you know, and spacing the floor just doesn't make much sense. I mean, as Seth has talked about a number of times, a good measure of kind of how modern a coach is how many catch and shoot long twos are your wings taking? And the Wolves continue to be very high up in that category. So I do think a philosophical change could help a little bit. Some things like not playing Levine at point guard, that sort of thing. All those would really help. I mean, I think Mitchell, sad as this to say, is probably someone who is closer to the bottom five. He's one of those guys where you really could upgrade even with an average guy. And so I do think it would make sense to do that.
Yeah, there are a couple different things with this. One that you talked about with the idea of moving on is something that is a big market inefficiency right now is that coaches aren't a part of the salary cap. So you can do that. You can make those changes. You can have sunk costs, and it doesn't affect your ability to add talent. Of course, it affects your bottom line, which does matter, but it affects it differently. And it's also hard sometimes to evaluate coaches because there is so much involved in player development that is outside of what we see on the floor. And that doesn't necessarily mean, oh, well, we can't judge coaches. It just means that you have to acknowledge that there's a part of it that we don't see. And that could be some guys are better at that than others. And we'll see how that moves on. But one of the things that I think about with this is also when you have particularly a young team, which is what the question asked is, are you putting players in a position that is reflective of what their event end game is? And so you think about like Karl Towns potentially shooting threes, Andrew Wiggins' offensive role, Zach LaVine playing the wrong position. Like those to me are things that are warning signs. You know, like that's my ideal coach would be using LaVine closer to what he actually should be in the long term, which to me has always been an off guard. You can check my old draft work. I mean, that's just something that was pretty established to me, not to everybody. And so that is something that's important. But other than that, you know, I firmly agree with you that if the person isn't right, then you move on. And we've seen that happen before. And it's not like having an assistant that's on a successful team or something like that is any sort of panacea either. It's just you just don't know. And so you have to try it until it works.
Yeah, Tom Thibodeau, who was fantastic as the Bulls coach for most of his tenure there, languished for like 20 years on a bench, you know, and didn't get a job. Steve Kerr, zero coaching experience before, ever. I mean, Greg Popovich was an NBA assistant a little bit, but was pretty unknown. You know, he coached like Pomona or whatever it was. Phil Jackson, not exactly a rising star before he became a great coach. Pat Riley, interim coach after the players revolted against the previous coach. You just don't know. You really don't. All right, here's one from McCulkey Cullen, clearly a real name. With so many teams giving the green light to three-point shooting, it seems like many smaller market teams are surprising us and doing much better than we thought. Is this the start of a greater trend? Can the small fish teams compete in this changing NBA landscape?
They can if they have elite talent. And that's really what this is. But if we're talking about competing, meaning like, let's say, going for championships or let's say the conference finals, which is the line I often use, you have to have MVP caliber guys to really be in that conversation. And at the present, a few of those guys, let's say like Paul George, you know, those Kawhi Leonard are in smaller markets. But that isn't necessarily because they're small markets or because of the three-point shooting. It's just that was the luck of the draw. You know, if Philly had won the lottery and gotten Karl Towns, or if LA had gotten Karl Towns, then that would be a guy who's there, or you know, things like that. So three-point shooting does equalize a little bit, especially as when it's in the underappreciated phase. But Kristaps Porzingis might be the real game-changing three-point shooter of this kind of next generation, and he's in the biggest of big markets.
Yeah, I think that maybe, and forgive me if I'm surmising incorrectly, but the idea of this question might have been from sort of the NCAA view, where a lot of people talk about, oh, three-point shooting in the tournament can be sort of the giant killer thing. Now, talking about a greater trend, you could argue that some small market teams, like the Spurs, for example, were on three-point shooting beforehand, but I don't think, off the top of my head at least, that there's a correlation between better three-point shooting and smaller big markets. And also, small markets have been competing for a long time very well in the NBA, and that's actually the biggest reason to me that I'm against any changes, any major changes to the draft, is because as much as you may deride the current system, it works as far as allowing small markets to compete, and the draft is the biggest part of that. And so if you change that, yeah, you know, it might make things fair, it could eliminate tanking, et cetera, but I think the unintended consequence of taking franchises into just utter hopelessness, you know, and hopelessness, not even if you're well managed, that you're just not going to compete for a championship, could be a big problem, where you have a team that doesn't have great draft picks coming along for the next 10 years and it's out of it. And it's just, all right, we're giving up on the next 10 years, essentially. So that's a bit of an aside. One thing I will say, though, and this is actually something I wanted to get to with Jared yesterday that we didn't have time for, is the idea that the luxury tax has like helped small markets, that small markets are better off than they were, I don't think that's the case. I think that small markets actually were better off under the previous luxury tax system because they could actually go into the tax to keep a contender together. Now, unless you have a really rich owner like Dan Gilbert, we saw the Heat, for example, have to make a luxury tax focused move. The Heat are not a big market, by the way, to get rid of Mike Miller. Maybe that ended up even costing them LeBron James ultimately due to his dissatisfaction. The Pacers and the Grizzlies have both had to make luxury tax focused moves at times when they were contenders as well. And so the only teams that can really afford to go deep into the tax now are very deep pocketed teams. Whereas before, you had teams like Portland, Indiana, when it was just the $1 for $1 tax instead of the super punitive one, it was actually easier for small market teams that were really good to keep their teams together. Now, the only ones who can afford to keep their teams together for a long time are the teams with the deep pockets to do so to pay the tax.
How you went through that without mentioning the Thunder just blew my mind. Like, that really, to me, is even the clearest example, maybe other than the Heat, because the Heat we have kind of more direct evidence, is that the Thunder, that was a part of what that was a part of what led to that happening. And yeah, I mean, there was a possibility that things could have worked out, but they basically sacrificed their best shot at being a dynasty for partially financial reasons.
Yeah, you make a great point there. And I think that that is something that just would not have happened under the old luxury tax regime. And we haven't really seen, Brooklyn was still willing to go for it. And I'm sure once the Knicks are good again, they will. I mean, to the extent that those teams aren't paying the tax, it's more just because there's more of a chance for flexibility now with this new cap environment.
Well, wait, can I say one more thing on this? There is another huge impact that hasn't been felt because a lot of the management of the big market teams has not been good. But that incentive to have the tax be that punitive, also it is a light encouragement for big market teams to spend their money more judiciously, which is the worst thing for small market teams, because if those big market teams have the cap space and are spending their money more judiciously, they could actually compete for free agents more regularly, as opposed to now where basically, other than teams that have been just moribund, we haven't seen those teams be competing for free agents. We haven't had a young, positive Lakers team competing for free agents.
Yeah, and I can't really think, even under the old regime, of a team that just became a contender solely because it was willing to spend. Maybe you could look at Portland in the early 2000s. They really only put together a team that was a contender for 2 years, though, by spending a lot, and then they kind of win. The Knicks famously spent the most in luxury tax and were terrible. I guess the Mavs were able to kind of keep things together and make a little bit more kind of money-focused moves to bring guys in. The Lakers, I don't think that, their ability to acquire Pau Gasol was because they were willing to spend more, and then they basically just spent to kind of keep their guys together. I mean, I think if you just reduced the luxury tax but kept all of the other to just one-to-one where every team could afford to pay it if they had to, if they really had a contender that they wanted to keep together, I think that that is good for the league, for good teams that are homegrown to be able to stay together instead of having what happened to the Thunder happen. Then all the other restrictions would be plenty fine to keep teams from just going crazy and using their finances as a huge advantage, especially the idea that you can't acquire a player in a sign and trade once you're over the tax. I think that's one of the biggest ones that would really prevent, large market teams from using the advantage if everyone could afford to pay the tax.
You want me to pick one? I don't remember.
We were on
that question for so long, I don't even remember who asked it. But okay, so Ahmad Daman, in your opinions, what is the easiest position to build around?
I think actually a great wing is the easiest position to build around, because then you can just go for a little bit more of a caretaker, shooter, defender type at point guard. You can still run pick and rolls just as easily. The other team has to have a really good wing defender to guard you, which are fairly rare. And you're also just, there are less good wings than anybody else, especially good offensive wings. And so it's easier to have a great offense when you have a really good wing, because you're getting more value out of replacement position offensively from them from there than anywhere else.
And I think that's more true now than it was. I could make the argument that it would be a big just because the best bigs can do things that are really hard to counter. But from a functional perspective, the star bigs that we've seen, first of all, they're fewer and further between, and they are, in today's world, they're getting easier to counter. Like, I mean, of course, if you had somebody like, let's say, prime Tim Duncan right now, I think he would still be doing really well, or prime Shaq, we've discussed in previous podcasts. But a star wing, you can build around that in a much easier way. But the best of the best, you know, the best of the best at any position right now, I think you can do really well with.
Yeah, that's true. The other thing that comes to mind here is the reason why Team USA is just so dominant. Most other countries, actually, other good countries have bigs to match up reasonably well in FIBA play, but they just have nobody even guard our wings at all.
That's true.
I mean, there's nobody on the – I mean, Giannis is really probably the only international wing who can physically match up with some of the wings that the U.S. has, and the U.S. has, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 of those guys. Yeah, and I think also just a wing is less likely to compromise your defense. And point guards, there are a lot of good point guards. You know, Amin Elhassan always likes to talk about, can you find a reasonable facsimile? And a good offensive wing is probably the hardest thing to find a reasonable facsimile of. Okay, let's see here. This is from Rodrigo Enge, I think, E-N-G-E. Is there any market left in the NBA for Nene and Varejao? Both are veterans with expensive contracts and have been struggling with injury troubles.
The important words here are expensive contracts. And so I think that if they were at a low price, the answer is yes. They're
well, and Nene at least expires at the end of the
year. Yeah, so I think there is a place for both of them in this league. But the problem is that they're at a price right now where that gets a little bit prohibitive. If the Wizards really fell out of it and, let's say, did a buyout or even were considering a trade with Nene, I think he could end up somewhere that a team would really be happy with him. But you need to see that happen. And Varejao, LeBron really likes him. He's important. He's a guy that's not really at a value that's tradable. So he's going to languish on the Cavs but be a break glass in case, you know, a bunch of their guys get hurt.
Yeah, I think that's right. Varejao is under contract next year with, like, you know, 97% of his $10 million or so guaranteed. Nene is a free agent. I mean, I think Nene is going to sign a contract as a backup center for, like, $5, $6, $7 million a year for a year or two. I think he's 33 right now, and he's probably at the point, especially from a health and reliability standpoint, where even with playing as a backup this year, he hasn't been able to stay healthy. And Varejao, unfortunately, looks like he's about done. I mean, he may get into better shape as the year goes on, but has not really been able to bring his trademark energy on the offensive glass, his ability to score and pick and roll, not as good as it has been. So, yeah, I think Varejao, I mean, you know, he's under contract for one more year. He could be trade bait for the Cavs as well, but just due to his salary. But I think that it is pretty likely with the path that Varejao is on, at least, that once that contract is over, that he'll probably be out of the league or veterans minimum. And there really also is just not that much of a need for traditional backup centers among the contenders this year, as we've talked about on previous programs with Roy Hibbert and trying to find a destination for him.
Okay, from Michelle Brad Stevens, again, completely definite sure name. You saw the Celtics. Do you think it'd be dangerous to look for a so-and-so superstar, their words, like Cousins and all his supposed problems, and not to keep this team chemistry?
Celtics ownership has said on many occasions that they care about championships, and that's all they care about. They're not trying to be good. I mean, and that was part of the impetus for the Pierce and Garnett trade, which was a great trade. I think they even thought that they were going to be worse and get some more of their own draft picks. But unfortunately, Brad Stevens is too good for that, and Danny Ainge has been able to put together a team with a lot of non-stars. But as was really hammered home to me again yesterday in that Cavs game, this is a team that does not have the ceiling without personnel changes, without really more of an offensive hub than they have right now, and even a great two-way big as well, just a guy who can pick and roll and then also protect the rim at an elite rate. I mean, Amir Johnson is an okay facsimile of that guy at times, but he's not going to be, in the long term, the guy who is going to be an elite starting center for you. So, yeah, I would absolutely trade for Cousins. I would sell nearly the farm to do so. I mean, I'd try to negotiate, obviously, but I would put in most of what they have in the cupboard, because especially in this Eastern Conference with no elite teams below Cleveland, I mean, I don't think they're better than Cleveland if they get Cousins, but they do at least have a way to score more easily as well. I mean, Cousins is someone who's always going to be able to create a shot for you at least, and that's something that the Celtics really lack at this point. So, yeah, I would make the move for him. And, I mean, the reason you do that is because they care about championships there. And it is a high-risk move, as I noted. They do have great chemistry. DeMarcus does not seem like a Brad Stevens kind of guy. He doesn't do quite as well with those sorts of players. But I think you got to do it. And because he's just that good. He's a top 10 player in the league.
I agree with everything you said, and the only thing that I'll add to it is that the Celtics have already shown an aptitude for picking up guys that are without requiring a ton of assets. So, you know, they can get the supporting pieces. They've shown they got Jay Crowder as kind of a part of the Rajon Rondo deal when people thought that the main part was the draft pick. And when you can do that, then that's an even better case for coalescing as many assets as you can into stars, because you can't do that for those, you know, like that's very rare to even have that possibility. And when you're in a place like Boston where you're competing probably against a wider swath for free agents than has happened in the past, yeah, there's a possibility that, you know, a Kevin Durant could go there, but it's less likely. So you need to put your assets in that way because it's your best chance of doing it.
The other thing about Cousins too is he's on a fantastic contract right now. I mean, that's the other thing, is that he's, you know, going to be making $15 million or so for the next 2 years after this one. So they already are slated to have a ton of space. They probably would lose some of it. Sacramento might want them to take on some bad contracts or whatever. But with Cousins there and some of the other assets that presumably would still be there, it depends whether they move guys on the current team or draft picks. I think they'd be more likely to move draft picks. Now, of course, Cousins is not available. We haven't seen any evidence that he is. The Kings are 9-8 when he plays. They are one game out of the playoffs right now, so I wouldn't expect, and they desperately want to make the playoffs for the first time in like 10 years going into the new arena. So I'd be very surprised if he's moved unless they completely fall out of it, which with this West I think would be very difficult unless there's another Cousins injury.
One more thing on that. That also illustrates the importance, even if it was almost definitely a no, of any time somebody puts somebody like that on the market, or even there's a murmur, of going after it hard, because whenever a team makes a mistake like that, that situation is the type that will resolve towards them not trading the guy.
When you talk about, especially if the guy's really good, they could always just like put, if they find the right mix around him, then all of a sudden they might be good enough to not want to trade him unless he's an impending free agent. And you look at, especially because Cousins is under contract for so much longer, and really it's via trade once every like 2 years, 3 years that really a transformational player is traded. I mean, you could look at Love and then argue about even whether he's a transformational player or not. I think he certainly was at the time. Then you go back to Harden as the last guy to get traded. Then Carmelo maybe, you know, a year and a half or so before that. Then maybe you would probably have to go back to like Pau Gasol as the guy before that who was traded. And correct me if I'm forgetting anybody, but it's really, you know, this idea, oh, we'll just hold out and wait for someone. It seems like in NBA history, there's like one of those guys every 2 years. So if you have a chance at one, like you damn well better take it.
And it's going to be less now with shorter contracts and more teams with cap space. It's going to be less frequent.
Yeah. This is a good one from Thomas Brian Wagers. If Towns, Simmons, and Wiggins were all in the draft, who would go first for the most amount of teams? And we'll assume that they're all, I mean, those guys all came out after their freshman year. So let's just assume that they are all, I mean, we know what we know about them now, but they're all basically the same age.
Okay, so age is not a consideration. So,
yeah, I mean, because obviously you would rather, you would say, all right, Towns is a year younger, so, you know, we've got him under contract for longer and et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, let's throw those considerations out of the window and just, you know, essentially, who do we think is going to be the better player long term among those three guys?
Okay, so first I'll acknowledge that I haven't seen as nearly as much of Ben Simmons as the other guys, so my opinion is less informed, and he hasn't played against NBA competition. But for me, the order is Towns, Wiggins, Simmons, because Towns is first because he's the guy who is that MVP candidate. He's the guy who has that special upside. We talked about it on the Prospects podcast, and the reason why I have Wiggins over Simmons is that Wiggins has shown more of an aptitude for forgetting his shot and things like that against NBA competition. And Simmons is a guy who doesn't trust the jumper. I love a lot of what he does. Same reason I was on board for Kyle Anderson and guys like that, and I think Simmons will be better. But his question marks are still question marks, and so that puts him below the other guys.
Simmons could be a potentially transformational player, especially I think he either should be a power forward or a point guard. But he has an enormous weakness right now that neither of those other guys, in that he just cannot shoot a jump shot at all. You know, he's got pretty decent touch sort of in the, like, 3 to 9 foot area with his floaters. He's ambidextrous around the rim with those. But as far as just a pure jump shot, he's almost entirely unwilling to even take them right now. And, you know, a three-pointer especially. So if he doesn't have the ball in his hands or learn to shoot, and he's a really long way away from that, based on both seeing him in person, seeing him practice, and then just the way that he has played this year at LSU, I think just when you have that big of a weakness, and it's enough to where, you know, I mean, like, Wiggins wasn't a great shooter as a freshman, but he at least felt comfortable taking them, whereas Simmons just, like, doesn't seem to at all, and, like, his jumper form just looks really weird. So, yeah, I would say probably, I don't know, I'll have to see a little bit more of Simmons. This answer could absolutely change, but Towns would be a clear one for me. And then just because Wiggins is kind of, you know, he's already averaging 20 a game in the NBA, he's just navigated kind of more than Simmons has. So I think ultimately Simmons would be third for me, but I may change my answer by the end of the year once I really get into the film. And of course, we'll do plenty of pre-draft podcasts 6 months from now.
One from Gordon Duffley. You guys keep talking about how teams have, quote, figured out the Bucks defensive scheme. What are teams doing specifically to beat it?
Well, I think it's more that the Bucks aren't executing quite as well as they did last year, in large part because Pachulia and Dudley, they're really missing those guys. So that's part of it. But in the Bucks scheme, overloads a lot. They put two on the ball a lot. And what teams are doing is when they run a pick and roll, especially, they are much like what the Spurs did against Miami in the 2014 finals. They are bringing another guy up basically as a release valve and for an easy pass. And then once you have a double team on the ball and the point guard, you know, 25 feet from the hoop, the roll man is free. If you throw it to that kind of release guy coming up, you know, I think it's basically called shorting the pick and roll, where, you know, it'll usually be the opposite big kind of coming up to the top of the key and then catching the ball. And then he's got that guy on the roll going right to the rim. Someone is then going to have to rotate off of a three-point shooter, and you're going to give up a wide-open three. And then the other part is just they are miserable on the defensive glass, and they're getting killed there as well. And just, you know, they give up a ton of cuts also. Like, they're really just the lack of discipline is not being covered up for by the intensity, and so they're giving up just too many easy shots and not able to force as many turnovers or, deny penetration nearly as well as last year. So I think that's the biggest issue is probably more with the Bucks than it is with teams figuring them out. I mean, you don't go from second to basically last in defense just because teams start doing, you know, some different scheme this year.
Yeah, I think that you definitely nailed it in terms of the two big differences being execution and personnel. And the personnel isn't as good. The other part is, while Jabari Parker is not, like, horrible defensively, he was generally being replaced by, I would say, better defensive players at the forward spots specifically for what they're doing, like Jared Dudley. Dudley, I think, is better at that than Jabari is right now. That will change in 3 years or 2 years or so, but just right now he's still young.
It may not, actually. I mean, Dudley is one of the more intelligent defenders that we have. I, you know, maybe not on the ball, just locking somebody down, but just in terms of, like, the way he helps and stuff. And that's not denigrating Jabari. It's, you know, a compliment to Dudley. All right, we got time for one more.
Or do you want to do two, or do you want to just do the big one?
I'm sorry. Yeah, we did skip one. All right, this is from Andres Garcia. Do you think the focus on fewer backs-to-backs /4 games in 5 nights will benefit the good teams more, resulting in better season end records because there will be less opportunities for schedule losses?
One word answer. Yes.
I am torn on this a little bit. I mean, I'm sure that there are plenty of times when bad teams might have competed, but because they're just really tired, they don't. And you could also even make the argument that part of being a bad team is that you're just not as mentally strong, and so when you're tired, you're not able to push through it as well, and that you're also bad teams are kind of younger teams, more dependent on effort, whereas good teams can kind of beat you because they know how to play. I mean, that's something that you heard the Warriors talking about a lot towards the end of the streak, that we could beat teams just so we know how to play, even though we're not playing that well. But on the other hand, as Kevin Pelton has noted, really good teams tend to turn it up in the playoffs. And part of that, I think, is just because they can be more locked in, because they feel better, there's more rest, and you're getting their best every night, and there are less vagaries. So I would say, ultimately, I don't think it matters that much. I might go slightly toward, and also, I guess, too, good teams tend to be older, and so maybe you can make the argument opposite of what I just did, that, you know, they need the rest more than other teams do. So yeah, I think it might favor them slightly, but I don't really have an answer to that. I mean, that is probably something that could really be answered, but I do not have the technical facility to do that.
Okay, I think last question.
Indeed.
From Billy Bizzle, the hypothetical. One of my favorite hypotheticals we've ever gotten. There's 6 minutes left in the All-Star game. The West is up 3. Whichever Warriors coach is the coach calls timeout and pulls Harrison Barnes and Andre Iguodala out of the stands and throws the death lineup on the floor.
Oh, wait, hold on. You're not going to say Steve or Luke Steve Walton Kerr?
Luke Steve Walton.
Which is what the guy said? I thought that was actually pretty
funny. I didn't know how to pull it off, so I skipped it. So they put the death lineup on the floor, given the lack of continuity, and that they're like for the other side, and that the scheme would be simplistic. Who are the four players on the East other than LeBron who you would put on the floor to counter the death lineup?
All right, what's your answer first?
Okay, so for me, there are a series of guys that are the non-negotiables for me are LeBron, Jimmy Butler, and Paul George. Like, I think those guys just have to be a part of it because they're versatile.
Completely
defensively.
Agreed.
Point guard, you could go Kyle Lowry or John Wall. I would lean towards Lowry just because his jumper is a little bit more consistent, so that's something they'll have to respect because you have enough guys that can handle the ball and initiate, but you could do that either way. The last spot was actually the one that I was the most intrigued on, and I thought about it, and the three guys that I really seriously considered were Chris Bosh, Paul Millsap, and now I'm trying to remember who the third guy was. I feel like Rick Perry and that.
All-Star starter Kristaps Porzingis, Danny.
No, not.
He's gonna be on the team.
Yeah, I mean there is an argument there, and I love that you suggested it. I'm kidding.
I know. By the way, he better not start the All-Star game.
Well, the other guy is Nicola Batum. So any of those three guys, my feeling is to lean towards Bosch just because I think he can do a lot of things well, and I think he can handle it enough on the switch. But if you went with either of the other two, I'd be fine with it.
I agree with you that those three guys are non-negotiable. Maybe the question is, do you even need a point guard at all? I went with Wall because I think his switchability is better, and just especially in a situation where these guys haven't played together, you're just going to need to just switch everything. I mean, that's the only way to do it. And so Wall, I think, you know, maybe Draymond Green could post him up, but ultimately he's much better in that role probably than Lowry is. Well, Lowry, you know, is a bulldog. He's not going to just give up. And he is a good defensive player, but, and does provide a little bit more shooting. So maybe they would be better with Lowry, but I would love it to just go with another wing. I mean, you have LeBron can bring the ball up, you know, and probably going to have the ball in his hands a lot anyway. So you might as well just go with another wing and get even more wing defense and switchability in there. But I think the East is kind of out now of good defensive wings who are realistically actually going to make the All-Star.
The only other guy that could fit is Avery Bradley.
Well, he's not going to make the All-Star.
He might. So. He might be. You could make an argument he's the best choice for the Celtics.
Oh, man, I might have to retire if Avery Bradley makes the All-Star game.
That actually, like, I was talking...
There's got to be some. I mean, not that he isn't having a great season, but there's got to be somebody better.
I will do my small pitch right now for that the All-Star game should not be East versus West. It should just be all the deserving guys. Because Avery Bradley is having a nice season, but if guys like Lillard...
It's going to turn into, like, even more of a sorry exhibition, though, if you don't at least have some sort of...
It is a sorry exhibition. Even, like, that's
fake,
the point. That's the point.
They at least try hard for like the last 5 minutes.
They would still try hard if it was random teams. I think, well, and of course I'm evil, so I would want the players to pick the teams, but that's just because I'm me.
Yeah. Now, Millsap to me is the guy who, you know, has to kind of be in there as the big two. He can switch well enough onto most players. I mean, maybe you couldn't necessarily guard Steph. But yeah, I mean, I can't think of, they're not going to have so many wings on this roster. You know, if I were really just trying to make a roster out of players in the East, not just guys who are going to make the All-Star team, you know, I might throw in like a Chris Middleton or Jamari Carroll, that sort of guy who could, you know, could switch on to Steph no problem and just go with really all wings. But yeah, it would be, I mean, I think with the continuity, that team would probably still would not do that well against the death lineup, but it would be awesome. And unfortunately,
did I tell you my other All-Star idea for this year?
Here we
Warriors
go.
Warriors versus the rest of the U.S. versus the rest of the world other than the Warriors in the U.S.
Wait,
so you take the Warriors out of you take the Warriors out of the entire equation, and then you just have those as other pools, and so you don't necessarily do a single game, but I'm just thinking that combination of players would be really fun.
Yeah, I think that's probably right, but I don't know. I mean, I think U.S. versus the world is probably the only way that I could really look at it, but then you'll probably get too many undeserving players. I mean, being an All-Star just means so much, and it's even baked into the collective bargaining agreement to determine how much you're going to get paid, and there's been research that shows that if you make the All-Star team compared to someone who has totally similar stats who doesn't make the All-Star team, you get paid more. So it means so much that I think whatever you can do, I mean, people say, oh, it's for the fans, blah, blah. Yeah, that's fine as long as it doesn't actually determine how much guys are going to get paid and stuff like that. As long as it does that, I think you have to be as fair in the process of selecting All-Stars as possible.
Speaking of that, did you see the thing I wrote about or I tweeted about Anthony Davis?
No, what is it?
So Kobe switching to the front court conceptually takes a front court spot from the Western Conference, and that is one of the potential ways that Anthony Davis could get the Rose Rule. And if he doesn't, let's say he isn't chosen as a starter, let's say he's the fourth front court player, which I think is entirely possible with Durant, Blake Griffin, and, you know, some of the other guys that are around, Kawhi if he gets popular. And so if that happens, then he has to make one of the All-NBA teams. Of course, that is expected, but it would become not a certainty anymore.
Yeah, that's especially if they don't make the playoffs. Maybe he doesn't. I don't know. We would have to really go through it and see. All right. That'll do it for today. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for the questions. We'll probably be back with another mailbag tomorrow because this was really enjoyable. And, of course, we need content.
yeah, that's what we need.
Which also helps. I have something to plug, actually. I wrote a piece on how the Magic, Thunder, and Bulls are doing with their new coaches and how they are using the personnel differently if they can, or in some cases not using the personnel differently that they have, and sort of taking the temperature of those teams with their new coaches at the Cauldron. I'm going to share that on Facebook in a second. So hopefully you can check that out there on my Facebook page, Nate Duncan NBA. Danny, how about yourself?
I'll have a new Real Jam Radio tomorrow. As people who listen know, I don't say my guests until I've recorded because I don't like in case something happens and they can't record, but that'll be up tomorrow and it'll be good.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. If you want to support the program, that cap space code on SeatGeek is a great way to do so and get yourself some cheap tickets or sell your tickets. And also an iTunes review or rating can be really helpful to the program as well. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you all next time.